All right, well, it's a widely held belief that to bring about meaningful change, the mass of people first have to be educated out of their backward ideas. However, other than the rich and the middle class, or the sections of the middle class that think that they too can make it to the top, most people are pretty cynical about the glories of capitalism. They don't rejoice when BHP Billiton or Telstra announce their record profits. They're not lining up to be, you know, members of the Rupert Murdoch fan club. The image of workers as a mindless mass, brainwashed by the media into accepting whatever capitalism dishes up, reflects not the reality of today's situation, but rather the elitist attitudes of the middle class and the academic world, as well as the wet dreams of the capitalist class. So in this talk, I want to debunk some of these dominant ideas and give a Marxist analysis of how it is that the ruling class rules, of the relationship between power and ideology, and importantly, how it is that workers do break from the dominant ideas that this system feeds us. The power of the capitalist class, to begin with, is based primarily on their ownership and control over the means of production, the raw materials, the land, the machinery, the factories, the office blocks, the shops, and so on. All that the rest of us have is our ability to labour, which we have to sell for a wage to the capitalists. So by and large, workers don't turn up to work because, you know, they're really committed to the capitalist project of increasing the profits of their boss, you know, or because they really love their job, though some people do. They turn up to work because of what Marx called the dull compulsion of economic facts, by which he meant that in order to survive in this system, workers are compelled to work for a boss. And this capitalist class, they make all of the key decisions in our society. They decide what gets produced, where it's distributed, and under what conditions. They control the pace, they control the intensity, and they control the quality of our work. And they decide who gets a job and who doesn't. And at a stroke of a pen, they can ruin millions of people's lives. And if we don't like our pay, if we don't like our benefits or our working conditions, we can't fire our boss or, you know, vote, you know, to change our boss or whatever, to change the conditions. In other words, because of their economic power, this unelected minority of owners and top managers largely determine the shape and direction of our society. So any analysis of power in our society needs to come to grips with this central fact. Now, the power of the capitalist class is most obvious at work, but their power doesn't just stop at the factory gate or at the office block foyer. Backing up the capitalist economic power is the modern state, whose institutions include the parliament, the state bureaucracy, the judiciary, the police and the armed forces. And the dominant view of the state is that it's a neutral force standing above society, that it sort of is there to battle, to sort of arbitrate between the two sort of battling classes, or even that it's there to reconcile their interests. But in reality, the state is dedicated to maintaining the rule of the capitalist class, maintaining their power. As Marx concluded in the Communist Manifesto, the executive of the modern state is but a committee for managing the common affairs of the whole bourgeoisie. The modern state, the capitalist state, creates a particular type of order, an order which both regulates the ruthless competition between capitalists, but importantly, it also enshrines the right of the rich and powerful to exploit the vast majority, enshrines the right of governments to launch imperialist wars against the wishes of the vast majority, of the courts to imprison and to deport desperate refugees, and of the racist cops to harass Indigenous people. At the core of the state are institutions and people who are immune from any kind of, you know, modicum of democratic accountability. And these include the military generals, the police chiefs, the upper levels of ASIO, secret services, the top bureaucrats and of the government departments, the leading bankers and the judges. And this is disguised, however, by the facade of parliamentary democracy in some countries, by the fact that, you know, we have one person, one vote. It can seem like we do actually have a determining role in the future of our society. But on this subject, Lenin wrote, although the sort of democracy that we have in countries like Australia is a great historical advance, it always remains, and under capitalism is bound to remain, restricted, truncated, false and hypocritical, a paradise for the rich and a snare and deception for the exploited and the poor. Deceit, violence, corruption, lying, hypocrisy, and oppression of the poor are hidden beneath the civilised, polished and perfumed exterior of modern democracy. So top politicians can sometimes be trusted members of the state's inner circle. John Howard certainly was, and Kevin Rudd is as well today. However, at other times, elected politicians can be tossed aside, and this is precisely what happened in 1975 when the Governor General at the time, John Kerr, dismissed the popularly elected government of Gough Whitlam after Whitlam failed to do enough to contain working class struggles when world recession was really starting to wreck the world economy. But ultimately, when the capitalist class faces a popular challenge to their rule, when they feel that their actual power as a class, you know, their survival is being threatened, they are all too prepared to throw away the rule book of bourgeois democracy and to resort to violence. And this is exactly what happened in Chile in 1973, when the military physically eliminated the government of Salvador Allende and set about systematically murdering and torturing tens of thousands of working class militants in a particularly savage and grotesque display of the true nature of the bourgeois state as an instrument of oppression. So blood, torture, horror and death back up this inequitable system. One of the most... That would not be page three. But capitalists, especially in liberal democracies, don't rule primarily by repression or by force. For much of the time, the key to maintaining order is the ideological apparatus that promotes ideas that serve the interests of the capitalist class, that promotes ideas that serve to justify and to buttress the economic and political domination of this class. And this is nothing new. As Marx and Engels wrote in The German Ideology, the ideas of the ruling class are in every epoch the ruling ideas. The class, which is the ruling material force of society, is at the same time its ruling intellectual force. So the ruling ideas try to make the structures and inequalities of our society seem natural, that they seem permanent, that they're inevitable, that we can't do away with them. So, for instance, Aristotle, who was one of the key philosophers of ancient Greece, whose production, you know, the production of this society was based primarily on slavery, he argued that there exists in the human character a natural slave. He wrote, and I quote, that from the hour of their birth, some are marked out for subjection, others for rule. For centuries under feudalism, peasants were taught that the social order on earth, the church establishment, the kings, the ruling class who exploited them, was ordained by God. And today, under capitalism, we're told that competition and racism are products of some immutable human nature, that poor people are lazy and that success comes through hard work, that revolutions always end in tyranny, and that society ultimately can be changed through, you know, gradual parliamentary reform. So these are what are called common sense ideas, or ideas which exist at a level of gut instinct that sort of, you know, really shape our sort of just general conception of the world. And this is why when people read our magazine, Socialist Alternative, we're always accused of bias. Our arguments, like the argument that workers can and that they should overthrow capitalism, butts up, it jars up against this common sense. On the other hand, The Age seems to be an unbiased news source, and yet The Age is but a more liberal version of the dominant ideas which reflect the interests of the bosses. Now, these common sense assumptions, these ruling class ideas don't just emerge out of thin air. They require institutions and groups of individuals to popularise them, to transmit them throughout society. And these institutions are the church, the media, the education system, political parties and trade unions, which act like capillaries, which help to sort of transmit, to spread these dominant ideas throughout society, which help to sort of, you know, through the individual relationships and stuff, help to bind, you know, workers to the existing order. But the ideas which bolster the status quo dominate not because of some one-way transmission bout where workers are brainwashed by the prejudices expounded by the Packer family's media empire, by the speeches of the ACTU president, if anyone listens to them. Rather, ruling class ideas take hold because they connect in many ways with the lived experience of workers under capitalism. So, you know, one of the sort of easiest, I think, concepts to get a grasp of is the sort of idea that competition is just, you know, part of human nature. So You know, this idea is clearly reinforced by the lived experience of workers under capitalism, that they have to compete for the limited jobs that are on offer. They have to compete at school. Students have to compete for the limited, university places. They have to compete for marks. And really, the whole existence or the whole structures of capitalism are really, the key dynamic is one of competition, of a competitive accumulation of profits. And this really sort of flows throughout society. But also another example is the idea that workers can't run society ourselves, that we need bosses, managers and experts. And this idea isn't irrational or mindless either, because under capitalism, as individuals, we don't have a say. We don't exercise any productive, any control over the productive process or the things that we produce. At work, we're under the dictatorship of the boss. And because of this fact, our capacities to organise and to run society are stunted and undeveloped. So the idea that workers can run society themselves just seems like a complete utopia. When, you have the experience like I've had, in the hospitality industry, when you have to ask your boss even to go to the toilet. So the idea that you yourself could actually take charge and have a real say over society just seems so far-fetched from this lived experience. So underlying this lack of confidence in our own abilities to take charge of society is the reality of what Marx called alienation, which stems from this lack of control over the productive process. Our ability to work, our breath, our energy, our sweat, our imagination, our creativity, rather than being something in which we can affirm our humanity, affirm our sense, our ability to labour over, to shape our environment, our ability to labour is simply a commodity, like a piece of meat or a mobile phone, to be bought and sold like anything else. What's more, we produce commodities solely to be exchanged on the market in order to make a profit for the boss. The products of our labour take the shape of an alien form. They take the shape of capital, ultimately, and this capital dominates our lives as workers. It stands over us. And as Marx put it in Capital, as in religion, man is governed by the products of his own brain. So in capitalistic production, he is governed by the products of his own hand. So this alienation produces a profound sense of powerlessness that pervades every aspect of workers' lives. Our relationships with other people are shaped by the fragmented and competitive way we live. City life brings us closer together than ever. And yet, anyone who's been on a train during rush hour, knows that feeling of isolation, of atomization. Our personal relationships and sexuality are distorted. Nothing escapes the confines of the market and commodification. Unlike production in peasant societies, in which most things were produced for immediate consumption, with a proportion of the products being taken by the landlord, being expropriated by the landlord, and perhaps if there's something left over, you've too many pigs, you can go down to the market and exchange them for some leather or carrots or whatever you need. Under capitalism, we don't work to produce the things that we need. Rather, we work for money, which we then use to buy commodities on the market. However, we have no idea what went into the production of these commodities. They just appear as things, things which have an independent life of their own, not products of human labour. So, for example, Nike shoes are the product of an ensemble of thousands of people's labour, of the people who, produce the leather, the people who produce the shoelaces, those that assemble or construct the shoe in the misery of the sweatshops in places like Vietnam, sweatshops that have recently been on strike, mind you. Those that have to transport the shoe, those that have to package the shoe and so on. So in every step of the process in the production of this Nike shoe, human labour has had to go into it. And at every step, there's a social relationship of exploited and exploiter. But the social relationship of exploitation is hidden. It's not apparent when we buy, these Nike shoes in the dazzling, clean and airy department stores. So as consumers, we're disconnected and divorced from the realities at the point of production. And the market itself is also something that which appears to have an independent life of its own, that appears to be something that's as natural as weather and beyond human control, even though it's actually a product of human creation, fueled every day by human labour. It appears that it's the market itself which decides what gets produced and so on. It seems that, you know, the market is actually imbued with, you know, human powers. You know, not only does it have the power to decide, or, you know, it also has feelings as well, you know. It goes into a period of panic and, you know, you know, it's feeling underconfident at the moment. Particularly at the moment, it is feeling rather depressed and yeah, exactly. So Marx called this whole process commodity fetishism. And this is also something which is about the sort of the process, even in the workplace itself. Even in the workplace, there appears to be an equal exchange between, you know, two commodities, between wage labour and capital. In exchange for our ability to labour, workers receive a wage. And in exchange for the boss's contribution of raw materials, the factory, the machinery, they get a profit. Seems pretty fair, or at least, you know, you just got to fight for a bit of a fairer distribution. But to understand the real dynamics at play, we need to get beneath the surface appearance of things to the reality that all profits are a product of workers' labour, that all profits are a product of workers getting paid less than the value that their labour produces. So this gulf between the surface appearance of things and the reality makes it difficult for workers, for the mass of ordinary people, to understand how capitalism really works. Alienation and commodity fetishism are things which reinforce the feelings of powerlessness. And as I said, these feelings are perfectly rational under capitalism. And this is the soil in which reactionary ideas of capitalism can take hold. So the way that people are, their values, the beliefs, their abilities cannot be separated off from the sort of society in which we live in, the sort of way that production is organised. So far I've painted a fairly pessimistic picture of how the mass of workers can accept ideas which are in conflict with their actual interests. But it's painfully obvious that workers do resist, that they do go on strike, they do strike, they do demonstrate, they do riot. So what makes workers resist? Well, we can rule out a few things. It sure as hell isn't the age, which, you know, really encourages workers to fight back, nor is it because our teachers at school give us picket line training. If only I had learnt that, maybe it would have been worthwhile. Workers resist because capitalism forces them to. At the heart of capitalism, there is a fundamental conflict of interest between workers and bosses. We want better wages, they want to increase their profits. They want to hold down wages to do this. What's more, capitalism is a crisis-ridden system, unable in the long run to provide a decent standard of living, not only for people in the third world, but also for people in the first world, in the wealthiest countries. As economic crisis sets in, workers and the poor are the ones that are expected to pay by sacrificing their living conditions, which is what we're beginning to see right now in America. In addition to economic crisis, there's also the inevitable wars, which stem from the sort of competitive nature of the system, which also create turmoil and upheaval. So it's the endless attacks on workers' rights to organise, cuts to welfare, the brutal and barbarous wars. It's all of this which push workers to fight to hang on to what they have. But this doesn't mean that workers will fight. In many situations, they do submit, understanding only too well that they're being screwed. They may think that no one will support them if they fight. Their union leaders may tell them that there's no point in fighting, and it can seem like nothing will break their passivity. But sometimes, when you least expect it, enough is their rallying cry. And so around the world, whether it's childcare workers in Glasgow, textile workers in, you know, northern Vietnam, car workers in Sao Paulo, or school teachers right here in Melbourne, the working class starts to move. The class moves despite the ideas in their head. And Gramsci summed up this process well when he wrote, "One might say he, or she, the worker, has two theoretical consciousnesses, or one contradictory consciousness, one which is implicit in his activity and which really unites him with his fellow workers in practical transformation of the real world, and one superficially explicit or verbal, which she has inherited from the past and uncritically absorbed." So in other words, workers' ideas can often lag behind their actions. And one of the most important expressions of this contradictory consciousness that workers hold is the support for mass reformist parties like the Labour Party. Traditionally, as the working class has developed, it hasn't just sort of accepted point blank all of the dominant ideas of society. Rather, it's developed a political outlook of justice, of wanting change, of wanting equality, while at the same time as accepting the common sense ideas that we have to play by parliamentary rules. Here we see a combination of acceptance of ruling class ideas together with their partial rejection, where common sense ideas coexist with what Gramsci called good sense, ideas that begin to express the real experience and interest of workers, even if it's just initially in a sense of, you know, us versus them. Trade unions are also an expression of this contradictory consciousness. Workers can be mobilised in their trade unions to fight for higher wages and better conditions against their employers, while still at the same time accepting the idea that workers, you know, need to make sure that the industry that they're in has to remain competitive, that the profits in this industry have to, you know, stay high. But whatever the limitations of trade unions, their existence both shows that capitalist exploitation forces workers to collectively organise, but also it expresses a willingness to resist. And it's in the moments when workers take a stand and protest and go on strike, whatever the limits of the immediate question, their experiences can challenge the ideas which they've previously accepted. And in the process of changing their circumstances, in the process of changing the material world, they can also start to change themselves. And this is the idea that was really developed in both in Marx's thesis on Feuerbach and the German ideology. And this is why Engels referred to trade unions as schools, and why Lenin argued that the real education of masses can never be separated from their independent, political, and especially revolutionary struggle. One of the most important things about struggle is that it can break the normality of everyday life, its subservience. It can sort of, you know, create a rupture with that sort of everyday lived experience and give workers a sense that they do have power, that if they shut down their workplace, if they go on strike, not only can they, you know, stop the process of production, they can also, you know, stop the flow of profits. The experience of struggle can open their eyes to the true nature of the conflict at the heart of capitalism and reveal the fact that the police and the courts are set up against them and for the employers. They learn that the press defends the employers and tries to present workers' interests in a bad light. They can learn also the compromising role of the trade union officials and the ALP. And this sort of really important experience that, you know, struggle gives, the sort of the way that struggle can have a really powerful impact on workers' consciousness, was written about well by Sandra Bloodworth when she described a strike of the Cortex textile factory in Melbourne by migrant women in 1981. And she wrote, "The Cortex workers seem to fit the stereotype of passive, submissive, easily exploited migrant women. Yet their 10-day strike involving 300 women brought about enormous transformations. On the first day of the strike, by the time 300 of them had picketed their factory and marched to another factory nearby and brought all the workers there out on strike, they began to feel their collective strength. It was now they began to talk of their oppression and super-exploitation, talk bitterly of the conditions they had endured for years, and drew up a log of demands. When the officials refused to bring out the scabs working inside, the women's response was to say, 'We'll strengthen the pickets and no one will get into work.' These strikers had broken out of a bondage of lifetime. They were not about to sit quietly and be defeated. After the pickets had stopped a couple of trucks from entering the factory gates, the excitement and exuberance which erupted was so infectious that those visiting the picket found themselves caught up in Turkish dancing and learning songs about cutting out union officials' tongues." And this is, you know, the kind of transformation that can happen well short of a revolutionary situation. This is just in the sort of day-to-day struggles of workers, though it was obviously clearly an impressive strike. But in revolutionary situations, this process of transformation can go much further. And Gramsci wrote about the powerful impact that struggle can also have on working class consciousness when he wrote about the sort of wave of factory occupations that swept northern Italy between 1919 and 1921, known as the Bonino Rosso, the two red years. And this this movement involved, you know, something like 1 million workers in the north of Italy occupying their factories and putting them under the control of workers. And so in some of the most beautifully poetic words, he wrote, "It was really necessary to see with one's own eyes old workers who seem broken down by decades upon decades of oppression and exploitation stand upright, even in the physical sense, during the period of the occupation, see them develop fantastic activities, suggesting, helping, always active, day and night. It was necessary to see these and other sights in order to be convinced how limitless the latent powers of the masses are and how they are revealed and developed swiftly as soon as the conviction takes root among the masses that they are the arbiters and masters of their own destinies." Also, when the bedrock idea of capitalism, that the minority who own and control all of the resources in our society will make all the important decisions, begin to shake, it also calls into question a whole range of other ideas. These ideas can start to fall apart. Racism, sexism, and other bigoted ideas can start to be challenged as workers learn that whenever the employer or the state pits them against each other, they're weak, and that whenever they unite, they're strong. But none of this happens because some groups of workers are, you know, just smarter, they just get it. It's out of the battle to change their circumstances that workers can develop new ideas, you know, ideas like the need for solidarity, and develop a sense of their own potential power as a class. This is one of the reasons that Socialist Alternative, for instance, is always arguing to be active over our grievances and not to be passive, not to rely on lobbying or the ballot box. But Marxists don't just sit back. We don't just sort of sit back and, you know, watch the struggles erupt from the sidelines. We don't just sit back and worship spontaneity. In every movement, there is a contest of ideas. In every movement, there are debates between different organisations representing different class forces often. You know, debates about the way forward. And in these times of working class upheaval, the trade union officialdom or reformist leaders often step to the fore, and they often step to the fore by donning quite left-wing rhetoric. I've actually, you know, had the experience of one of my history lecturers I guess it's not quite an example of the trade union officialdom, but nonetheless, a member of the trade union, who tried to argue why the lecturers shouldn't go on strike by quoting Lenin. So they often they often adopt quite left-wing rhetoric to try and not to strengthen the struggle, not to lead it to greater and greater heights, but rather to contain it, to be able to put themselves at the head of it, but so they can control the movement. And so that the potential for workers' struggles to develop never gets realised. And their position as negotiators, trade union officials' position as negotiators between capital and labour, can be preserved. So if revolutionaries are to win the battle of ideas, to make victories more likely, we need an organisation that coheres thousands of anti-capitalist workers, that can win the majority of workers to the idea that they themselves can and must pose an alternative to capitalism. But this kind of, you know, winning of workers can only happen in the heat of the struggle by being a part, intervening in the day-to-day struggles that happen of the class. But even if we do win the battle of ideas, this is ultimately not enough. As I've argued earlier, when the ruling class feels that its economic and political power is being threatened by an insurgent and confident working class, they will not hesitate to use force. They will not hesitate to mobilise institutions of the state to crush the gains that workers have made. And it's at this point that history can go either way. And the crushing example of the working class and the example of the crushing of the working class and the restoration of capitalist order in Chile is a tragic example of this. The main political parties of the working class, such as the Communist Party, played the role of holding back the class struggle, of arguing that workers who had seized their factories should give them back to the bosses, of landless labourers who'd seized control of the land, that they should give them back to the land owners. And they also argued that the Chilean army was patriotic, that it respected democracy, had these, you know, really noble traditions, that it would never shoot a fellow Chilean, amongst other things. So if there had been a revolutionary organisation of thousands of class-conscious workers with an understanding of the bourgeois state and the need for workers to seize control over the centres of capitalist power, they would have stood a better chance of organising the kind of actions that were necessary to defeat the coup. So to sum up, the ruling ideas of our society are the ideas that justify and back up the economic and political domination of the capitalist class. And they, the capitalist class have, a whole array of institutions and ideological apparatus to promote these ideas. But workers are not blank slates. They're not mindless lemmings. Most of the time, workers combine acceptance of ideas that reinforce the status quo with ideas which reject it. To the extent which ruling ideas are taken up by workers is a product of their lived experience, of the struggles, of the level of the struggles, the traditions, and of their self-confidence. Workers don't need to accept, however, revolutionary ideas in order to struggle. Irrespective of the backward ideas in their heads, workers do struggle because capitalism itself creates the conditions of class conflict, which opens workers' minds to ideas quite opposed to those which normal life reinforces. So arguments which socialists, have made in normal times, which seem to sort of fall on deaf ears, that seem to have no resonance, can, in changed circumstances, be taken up by wider and wider layers of people as they as these ideas start to fit with actually their lived reality. But if the work, if the struggle of workers are to fulfil their potential, to challenge the rule of capital altogether, the intervention of organised revolutionaries is crucial. And I just wanted to sum up with this last quote by one revolutionary Marxist who put it this way. Conscious revolutionary practice is activity which makes use of the fullest possible understanding of all the social forces constraining and shaping human behaviour in order to tip the balance in favour of the working class and rescue humanity from the abyss.